Welcome to another edition of PBJ. It's Friday. How are you guys?
Happy birthday, America.
Happy birthday. 250, almost. Right?
250.
We came ready to represent today.
That's right.
Well, I like that.
Steve came super ready. He's looking fresh.
We got both Independence Day and World Cup.
Yeah.
And USMNT is looking fine.
Pretty damn good. They're looking fine. And DK had an important question, which is the World Cup still going on?
I thought they did that 2 weeks ago. Didn't we say it was the final?
Actually, so our producer, Alex, rarely makes a request of us. Yeah, so yeah. I think we need to honor it. He asked for DK's analysis of the World Cup.
Yeah.
So
what do you think?
I would love to honor Alex's request about something I could help with.
You need to ask Fable very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Get on your model, bro.
No. Well, I've been watching. How about you?
Hell yeah, I've been watching. It's been great.
It's been a great World Cup.
Absolutely good.
I think undoubtedly this is the best Americans team ever. Yeah. I think they need to win Monday to like solidify it.
Yeah.
But the way they're playing, I've just never seen this from an American team. Yeah. They actually have European level skills.
Easily.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I've been super impressed. I mean, the coach, obviously Argentinian, I think he's brought some of that swag, some of that Euro South America swag, which is great. I will say, you know, I'm a little concerned, you know, losing arguably our best or second best player for the next round, which that red card, by the way, that was some bullshit.
It was definitely controversial.
And you see, I don't know if this is true or not, I'm getting this secondhand from Anjali, but that Brazilian ref who called that has, I think, testified in a, you know, sort of sports gambling case before in Brazil.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's
I think
true,
a Venezuelan was behind VAR, so maybe he's a Maduro.
Yeah. I can see it.
Guy.
That's some bullshit. But I have to
what's
say.
What's happening Monday? Is Monday the final?
So, okay, DK, here's the structure of the World Cup. And it's actually different this year. Yeah. So even if you follow the World Cup your whole life, this year is different.
Yeah.
Usually there's 32 teams. This year there's 48 teams. They break them into groups of four. So 48 divided by four, there must have been 12 groups, right? 12 groups.
This is why Steve has to pay the big bucks.
Yep, that's why we bring the quantitative analysis on this show.
Matt.
So
he's ready to join Jane Street now.
There's groups of four, and you play round robin. So each team plays the other three teams in their group. And then emerging from that group, the top two get to move on to the next round, which is called the knockout stage. But this year, because there's 48 teams, the top eight third place teams got to advance as well. So ultimately, there are 32 teams that advance. Then it's a single elimination tournament, much like March Madness, where you win or you go home. So that just started in the past week. So it took like 3 weeks to play the group stage. There's about a week in between your games. Now we're in the knockout stage. After today, I think. Yeah, after today, the round of 32 will be complete. And so starting tomorrow, there'll be 16 teams remaining.
Sweet 16.
The United States played on Wednesday?
Yeah, it was Wednesday.
On Wednesday against Bosnia.
Herzegovina.
I don't know. That's where DK can come in on the geography. Or maybe Pav is listening. He can help us. He's from the region.
There you go.
But we won that game, which is what we were talking about, the red card. We played very well. We won 2-0.
Extremely well.
We were dominating 1-0. Then we got a red card penalty controversial. What that means, DK, is the player who got the red card is out of the game. You can't replace the person. So you're playing 11 on 10.
Yeah.
Or 10 on 11, which is obviously a disadvantage. But nonetheless, we hunkered down, played defense for about 10 minutes in that difficult situation. It honestly was looking a little dicey.
Yeah.
And then we like decided to attack and we scored an incredible penalty kick. It's the first penalty kick we scored in 32 years in a World Cup.
And one would argue actually we scored twice.
Yeah.
Now one got taken away because it was offsides, but it was, you know, it was impressive. Down a guy and the US team just like went full throttle. Yeah. Like, yeah, I was impressed.
So getting back to your question, what's Monday? Well, that's the next round for the United States. We play Belgium, who had an insane comeback from behind victory.
Yeah,
exactly. They're down 2-0, 80-minute mark.
Yeah.
I went out, I had a meeting.
Yeah.
And then an hour later, I look and I'm like, could not believe that they won 3-2.
It's extremely unlikely.
So we're playing Belgium on Monday, 5 p.m.
And Belgium historically has been quite good. I think the U.S. lost to Belgium. Was it last World Cup? World Cup
2014.
Yeah. oh, time flies. And so, you know, hopefully they're not that as good this year. But the fact that now with the red card, our best or arguably second best player will no longer be participating. So it's not great. But at the same time, like the fact that
we got to win. It's kind of a coin flip game.
Yeah.
I think we're slightly favored.
Now, what would be even doper is on Monday, you've got Spain and Portugal playing. And that's interesting for all kinds of reasons. One, you've got one of the retiring, you know, greats playing one of the young greats in Lamine Yamal and Ronaldo. But obviously, there's some like Spain, Portuguese, I'm sure a little fanfare going on there. Like if the U.S. plays Canada or something, I don't know.
Well, if we win, we'll play the winner of that game.
Exactly.
Which I think is doable. I mean, yeah. Cape Verde tied Spain. So I think we could win.
Yeah.
But then we would play France and then that's where.
Yeah, that's where stuff would get difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, look.
It would be an incredible success if we make it to the semifinals.
Even just getting to the quarters.
Is.
Playing against Spain or Portugal would be amazing. And, yep. And you know, look, once you're there, it's like March Madness. Anything can happen.
Yep.
So.
You feel up to date, EK? Yeah.
Somewhat, sports. Yeah. Yeah, a little bit.
go ahead.
Before we get on to the actual content topics of the show, I should mention that we are running a jamchat.fun.
I was going to say, that was the most important topic I had to talk about.
Kind of me too. I'm pretty excited.
I didn't even tell you. So. This is an authentic jacket here. What I went to the 2010 South Africa World Cup.
Okay.
And got this jacket.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you like bought it off one of the players or something. No. On eBay or something.
Landon Donovan.
Exactly.
Gave me this jacket.
He's now that I'm out. Yeah. Hey, you know what? Actually, I'm just going to put an idea out there. Many great ideas have come from the PBJ podcast. We should have a soccer league here. We should play soccer at the office. On the field. Alex, I'm gonna throw that out there. It would be amazing. I've got a ball, I can bring it.
We actually do. We have a nice field out here.
Yeah. So you heard it here first. You're interested in playing soccer.
See it on the show, but yeah.
Let us
down below the window, lots of grass.
We should do it. All right. I'm gonna follow up on that.
Only I'll play if DK plays.
Oh yeah. DK, you gotta
be there. I'll play when I'm back in town.
All right.
So did you give your Jam Chat pitch? What's the latest with Jam Chat? I think Matt enhanced it further.
I don't know the feature list of the enhancements, but jamchat.fun is where you go. There's one watching live right now, and that's Matt. So,
oh, we finally got a gold lane. So the new feature is he has another AI agent, a separate one, evaluating the results of the other AI agent, and anything that stands out gets put in the gold lane. And apparently...
Oh, so gold lane is like things that are actually interesting? Instead of just everything,
according to the other AI, and apparently it thinks itself is interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we mentioned Jam Chat.
I think it's more interesting. Who gave Landon Donovan this jacket? Steve Lee.
Yeah.
Why is it
Landon Donovan accepted the jacket from me?
Exactly.
I noticed that Jam Chat is providing the DK analysis. The expanded 48 team format is doing exactly what FIFA wanted: more chaos, more weird matchups, more penalty drama.
Oh yeah. It's very DK special.
They followed the footsteps of March Madness.
Yeah, exactly.
Much to the chagrin of the world.
I think it's been pretty cool. I like this format.
I like this year.
And it's nice because like it's cool that you get like, you know, countries like Cape Verde or whatever, Ivory Coast.
And they've represented.
And they've played
well. Spain.
I know. So like, I like it. I think it's good. Some change is good.
Let's see. We didn't have a show last week. And that's because I was visiting. I actually took a vacation for once and was largely disconnected, which is nice. I did a camping trip where the highlight.
That was both a social media and a work cleanse.
Yep, social media and work cleanse.
Yeah, you picked a good week while Bitcoin was crashing and MicroStrategy was unraveling. So that's good.
We can talk a little bit about that later too. People are clamoring to hear our views on strategy.
Yeah.
But let's see. Well, I'll just pick out one highlight of the camping week, and that was softball.
Oh.
So I've literally never played softball in my life. I played baseball as a kid.
Okay.
I was a mediocre baseball player.
Okay.
I played second base.
Okay.
I generally was able to field and get outs.
I feel like
I was not a slugger. I'm more of the hit by pitch, get on base and score kind of player.
Yeah, finesse. I like that.
Hence Moneyball.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't get drafted for my hitting a 500-foot home run. It's more like get on base, score, somehow get on base.
I doubt anybody involved with this podcast would. So
anyway, but I'd never played softball.
Yeah.
But this camp was all about competition, which I was excited about.
Yeah.
And so there's two different adjacent camps that had a big rivalry game.
Oh, cool.
As well as there's a game between the staffers and the campers.
I love it.
I played back-to-back days.
Yeah.
5 for 6 batting.
Okay.
Three ribbies. It was amazing. And they were actually like legit hits.
Oh, wow.
Not like a dribbler, but like fly ball, and the 4 outfielders could not get to it.
So you hit a home run then?
No. Double. The highlight.
Yeah.
The final inning.
Yeah.
We're down 9-6.
Uh-oh.
I'm up to bat. 2 outs, 2 on. Mm. Pressure.
Yeah.
Because also, like, there's a legitimate audience watching because all the other campers come to watch this game because it's the culmination of the week.
Don't mess this up,
Steve. They have a band.
Seriously?
Yeah. My team had a band. Oh, there's an announcer.
Oh, wow. This actually sounds
awesome. Sounds like this, you know.
We need this at PB.
So I'm feeling pressure, and I hit a double, knocked both runners in.
All right.
It was awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. But then we lost.
Yeah, well.
They didn't knock me in.
Not
I was
fault.
Like
exactly.
Ready. I was ready to score on a base hit.
Yeah.
Anyway. But then after the camping trip, went to Mammoth Lakes and actually was sitting in the chair that DK is in right now. So I saw the PBJ remote studio.
Yeah, and I saw the photo of it. It's like, it's a pretty impressive. I mean, DK is definitely known as a hobbyist, I would say, but you've done a good job there.
Yeah.
Thank you, yeah.
Representing the professionalism that we have here at the studio.
Yeah, right on. That's cool.
But yeah, I had not visited DK before in Mammoth Lakes. I'd never been to Mammoth Lakes.
What was it like?
It was great.
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, both DK and I like to run. So I ran on the 7,000 foot elevation track and experienced for real the oxygen deficit.
So you're going to be ready for soccer.
But that was cool. Then
a straw.
neither of us had done mountain biking before on a mountain, like a ski. Like, so we, you know, took a chairlift up and mountain bike down. That was a blast.
Cool.
What else we did? We did a hike, food. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like this cool serendipitous moment. So on the drive home, we were going to go through Yosemite. And I just wanted to find like a short hike, like less than 2 hour hike, because it was the day that I was going to drive home. And so we're at this dinner party, and I asked this guy I just met if he had any suggestions. And he had a suggestion. And it turns out, and then he hands me this book, and he's the author of like Yosemite rock climbing.
Oh, wow.
Book. He's like literally the perfect expert
to know everything. Alex Hanold or something?
He was basically Alex Hanold Jr. But no, I mean, he's literally the world expert on Yosemite high country.
Wow.
And he delivered. That hike was, I think it's probably the best 1 mile hike in the world. You get a little bit of everything. Beautiful forests and trees. This 600 to 800 foot wall,
amazing.
Like a El Capitan Jr. But you're right at the base.
Yeah.
And then one of those lakes that has a mirror effect and show, you know, it was a perfect day, like sunny with some clouds reflecting off the lake.
Is it super hot up there right now?
No, I think it was. And then when you showed up and then it was like in the like
cold snap.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's like feels like 23 at night.
Perfect.
That's usually up in Yosemite there, it'll be, you know, 70 or something, right?
Oh, so during the day, it doesn't get that hot.
It doesn't get too super hot. This is in the high country. The elevation, you're probably up at 8,000 feet or something.
Okay.
No, during the day, it was like 50.
Wow. Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Those are the World Cup and Fahrenheit. What's that?
How many kilometers was it?
Anyways, good trip.
Yeah.
But I'm back.
All right.
Let's talk about some topics.
Let's talk about some stuff. Where do we jump in today?
I don't know.
I feel like the goose stuff may be a good kickoff, right? Because
yeah,
I think we've touched on goose before. And I think goose is one thing to some people, and it's more abstract in the new incarnation. And so I feel like we should just set up what is goose and what's new in that world.
Sure. And it's a little bit of a teaser of what Spiral is going to announce next week as well.
Right. Alpha
so
drop.
That's why it's Alpha Drop.
Yeah.
If you want to know what's coming ahead of time, you listen to our show.
There it is.
Let's see. So for those unfamiliar with Goose, Block wrote Goose software to AI agent, and it was launched over a year and a half ago. I think it was January 2025.
Yep.
And so most people are familiar with it. It's a, you know, like a Mac desktop application. And it, you know, it predated Claude Code, Codex, OpenClaw, all these other now much more well-known AI agents and software. And it was quite
AI agent. It's kind of what I think maybe people traditionally call a harness now. Yep. It's not the model, but it's the thing that controls the model.
Correct. And it was novel along a number of dimensions. So I think looking back is a case of, like, interestingly, Block, which is known as like a fintech company, Square, Cash App, was really ahead of the game on AI. I mean, Jack has seen what's going to happen with AI for at least four years now. I mean, actually, way before that, Block acquired machine learning companies and have always been trying to use the bleeding edge of machine learning and AI within the company. But now, Block developed Goose early, had this powerful agent harness. But looking back, you know, I think the communications around the storytelling were, you know, much weaker than like a Claude Code. You know, Anthropic's obviously known for AI, Block is not. But I just feel like every time I open X, just the whole feed is filled with Anthropic content. Like, however they're getting it done, they're getting it done there. and it's certainly, they're delivering too. Like, Claude Code was an incredible experience. But looking at where, you know, looking at things as they stand today, and actually just looking at the sort of AI environment the past month, while OpenAI and Anthropic are clearly delivering and really good product experiences, there's also great fear about the control and power that each of them have and can have. We've talked about it on the show before. And I think a lot of organizations, whether it's a big enterprise or individuals or small groups, are worried about that. And there's at least a couple reasons you don't want to bake yourself into one vendor. One is just short-term pragmatism. Each month they seem to be leapfrogging each other. And then maybe Google out of nowhere could leapfrog. And like, you don't really want to place a bet on one vendor right now. You don't want to lock yourself into one model. So it's important to use software that allows you that flexibility. And then certainly medium to long term, there's just the risk of like one of these companies hoovering up all your data, competing against you, et cetera.
Or even the government forcing them to do, or like either shut down or hand over the data, which we've seen too. So.
Yeah. So looking at Goose today, I think, in addition to being like a novel, initially like a novel agentic harness, looking at it today, it's quite good at running, you know, being model agnostic, and also where the model runs agnostic. So you can use any model with it, open models, frontier models. They can run in the cloud, on your local computer, or even a peer-to-peer network over a project called Mesh LLM, which is part of the Goose suite.
Is there more to announce on that too? Because that is super cool.
Well, McNeil was the developer that created it earlier this year. I think February is when it came out. He actually came to PB in April and gave a talk on it, which was, cool. I think, DK, you were there. It was well received.
That was my favorite builder.
Yeah, it was DK's favorite builder. Nice. And what's been great about that project is like other contributors just quickly jumped on it and are major contributors now from, that's awesome. You know, from different people from different companies or just independent developers. Sure. So it's an independent project, but it certainly works within Goose.
And does Mesh LLM already have Bitcoin payment support?
It works. It does peer-to-peer inference, mm-hmm. but you're donating your compute.
Right.
So a natural extension or your roadmap would be to add a payment mechanism.
Yeah.
And I think we spoke a little bit on a previous episode about Matt Blaz's Buzz, Bitcoin experiments,
yeah,
and with a very simple experiment, but being able to pay for inference through that. So that's like a precursor to maybe what could happen in the future.
I love it.
With Goose and with Mesh LLM. In any case, I think looking at the landscape today, something that is like a public good, open source, agentic harness supported by a small core contributor team, it's kind of a fool's errand to try to directly take on the frontier labs and acquire 100 million or billion customers as a nonprofit. So I think what makes most sense for Goose is to focus on it as a development platform, mm-hmm. and an SDK. So one slight pivot for the Goose project is delivering a Goose development kit, GDK, in which anyone can build their own.
Where did they get the idea for that name?
I'll get to that in a second. So these are what's going to be exposed in this development kit is really nothing new. It's all the components that have been a part of Goose for the past year and a half. They'll be exposed in a Rust API. And that Rust API, there'll be bindings as well. So if you want to build in Kotlin or Swift or whatever other language, you can do that. Cool. Python, etc.
Can you talk a little bit about what you think this might enable? So we currently have seen what the Goose kind of IDE client looks like and how that works, and that's sort of already out there. And then the GDK is a set of, it's like a development kit that enables you to build all kinds of applications using that. What kinds of things might we think about? Are they other IDEs, other approaches to development, other types of AI infrastructure, applications themselves? Like, how do you think, what layer does GDK kind of live at, or well, what would be those?
Good question. So, like, historically, Goose has been and is thought of as just one application. There's like a mobile version and stuff too, but I think most people have used Goose. It's a desktop application and just one client. So you can imagine many different use cases and users, which is your question, and I'll get to that in a second. But for now, allow me to just say there's many use cases. And to imagine one application supporting all those different types of users and applications is difficult, right? So I think what I'm imagining is a future in which there's many types of applications to serve different user needs, and each of them can be built on this development platform.
And what parts do they hold in common? They all have that they want to dispatch or coordinate the activity of agents. Is that kind of the?
Yeah, what would be in common in sort of some of the modules of the GDK. One is an agent loop, in which you can pass in a prompt or an input, and have it do some tool calling. You know, pass it to the model, have it do some tool calling, do context management for your context window, and then iterate. I mean, this is like a common pattern now that's no longer novel,
like OpenClaw.
Yeah, which uses Pi underneath, which is somewhat similar to Goose. So that's one component. Then just being able to run any model you want, anywhere you want, and having all that done for you. Sure, you could build it yourself, but it actually takes a lot of great engineering work to get each model to run well within a given agent harness. So all that work will be done is done and will continue to get better by Goose, the platform, and by the Goose core team. And then there's dynamic model selection, which is now all the rage because people are realizing, oh, this is super powerful, but it's really costly to just send all work to the most powerful model. It makes a lot more sense to be smart about selecting which model you want to use. For jobs that don't require Fable or Mythos or the latest model, you can send that to a much cheaper model. Possibly an open model that's running on your local computer or over a peer-to-peer network. It's also, some applications are going to have privacy needs where you don't want to send it to somebody else's data center.
Totally.
And so with dynamic model selection, being able to like intelligently do that automatically and, in different client applications are going to behave differently. Some will just be for mainstream users, just do everything for the user automatically and try to be smart about it. Others will expose controls for the user to be, more in control of which model's used, when it's used, et cetera.
So I think this point is worth pausing on. DK, I know you've been long a proponent that something like OpenRouter is in a beautiful position, both sort of commercially and like where value gets created, because you're the ones that can, sort the different tasks. I don't know how OpenRouter works. Is there sort of like control system, or is it transparent? Do they have the algorithms clearly available for people to see how the models get routed? And even if they do, it's a closed company. I assume that could change over time. Well, to me, this is
structured more as a single hub for you to, you could like swipe your credit card once and you have a billing relationship with OpenRouter, and then you can light up whichever model you want. But I think the at least the traditional model and the model of how you would use OpenRouter today is less around automated model selection. That's a subset of model routing, of doing it in an automated way. But model routing more generally is you get to route each prompt to whatever model you want, right? And you can do that manually, you can do it automated.
Does OpenRouter already support, for example, plugging into like OpenClaw and some of these agentic frameworks?
I mean, well, you could, with OpenClaw, you could bring a key, and that key could be
from OpenRouter.
To OpenRouter, and then you could tell OpenRouter which ones you want to use. I don't think OpenRouter does a lot of the automated model selection yet, but that's kind of the core of how Cursor's business works. Right, is you download the Cursor IDE, you swipe your credit card, and you have a billing relationship with Cursor, and then you leave your little selection box on auto, and it just does something reasonable for you.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of margin to be made in doing something reasonable for you.
Totally. And what I love, though, about the opportunity for an open source project versus a company here is you, in theory, can make it much more transparent and tunable for the user to be able to decide how they want to route models. And like you could have, obviously, out of the box, this is what we recommend. But I assume some of these companies over time are going to be less transparent because this is where their margin comes from. I don't know. But it seems like that's a huge area of opportunity for any developer to have like complete flexibility and, you know, or whatever, in privacy or whatever tunes they want to change.
Yep. And let me give, I never did answer DK's question about the different use cases. So I'll give a few examples. There's, the obvious one that's talked about a lot right now, which is enterprises, right? And Block is a great example of a company using AI internally, just completely disrupting how the organization works in a really positive way, where all workflows, not just developers, but all employees of the company, their workflow has changed, and intelligence is at the core. Block's not alone. They're like, Coinbase has reported a lot of usage, and I think Stripe has, and a lot of tech companies are doing this. There's a lot of non-tech companies too that are very curious about this and see it as the future. I think they're a little less equipped than a Coinbase or Stripe or Block to do it themselves. And they might be looking for solutions.
Yeah.
And Anthropic and OpenAI are undoubtedly, ramping up with forward deployed engineers and going after that market. So that's one use case. I mean, in terms of the open source Goose project, that, you know, building on GDK, that's definitely for people who are do it yourself and pretty low level and pretty sophisticated with this. There's gonna be some enterprises, I think, that will want that, but I think many are going to want layers on top of that and services by a company. But nonetheless, that's one clear use case. But then you can go all the way down to the individual. And just speaking with people here at PB, just developers here, each of them have developed their own personal workflow and adapted how they develop software. And they're using AI, and they're using agents. They're using multiple agents. And some of them, you know, they're using Claude Code. Some are using Claude Code SDK to customize. But as they get more into it, they realize some of the limitations of a closed source SDK and one that's wedded to only one model. So they're starting to see, oh, I wish I had an open source SDK. And one that can support any model I want to run. So I think at the individual developer level, that they could take GDK, build their own client that suits their needs, and then anything in between, like an AI startup. Many AI startups are building agentic harnesses as part of the product offering. If you have a high quality platform, and especially, I mean, one thing we haven't said yet, but Block donated Goose to the Linux Foundation last year. Sure. So it's part of the Linux Foundation, and it's part of AAIF, which was formed last year. Block, Anthropic, and OpenAI created the Agentic AI Foundation. So it's that I think it's quite substantial in terms of lending credibility to this framework is being neutral. Because there's definitely other agentic SDKs and development platforms. But if you look at, you know, you have to ask yourself the question of what are the incentives and who's contributing to it? And the other ones are either from the big frontier labs or from a VC-funded startup. And there's nothing wrong with them open sourcing it and building that. That's great. More the merrier. But if you're going to build off of that, you do have to ask yourself a question, like who's contributing it? Are those contributors, are they prioritizing the commercial interests of their employer? Or are they creating a public good and a neutral platform? So I think having donated Goose to Linux Foundation adds credibility. And then this gets to another part of the Goose story, which is an organizational change within Block recently, and we'll officially announce next week, is that the six core developers of Goose moved over to the Spiral organization, which is my organization.
There you go.
And and so Spiral is now not just Bitcoin, but also AI.
I love it.
Similar to scope of PB itself and what we talk about on PBJ.
Yeah.
So we see a lot of alignment, and we think that move makes a lot of sense. One is the reason we're just talking about. In addition to the credibility that Linux Foundation provides for Goose, by having the core developers work under Spiral, while they're still Block employees, Spiral has a 7-year track record of prioritizing what's best for the public good and not overly prioritizing or being directed by Block the company. So while we don't have that track record in AI, we do have that track record in Bitcoin. And so anyone who's followed the story of Spiral knows that we genuinely do what is in the interest of the public good of Bitcoin. And we're going to bring that same ethos and DNA to AI. So I think that combined with Linux Foundation really allows Goose to stand out.
I love it.
That plus, obviously, Goose has to deliver super high quality software and always being on the leading edge of AI. And I think that project and those developers have been at the leading edge to date. So we need to continue that and create great software.
They need to hang out here to get the word out.
That's it. So I think the big improvement is the storytelling and awareness creation. People need to know that Goose exists and know what it's for. And so that's another thing that Spiral has done in the past in the Bitcoin world, which is storytelling through creative and somewhat, sometimes wacky, zany.
Jim Henson Goose can come in.
Creative project. So maybe we'll bring a little bit of that flavor to Goose.
I love it. I think that's awesome. I mean, I think, the more that we fuse open source intelligence with open source money, like all kinds of interesting things are going to happen. So. Yeah, I love that.
Can I ask a follow-up on the GDK stuff?
Yeah, but real quick, before I forget, a quick shout-out. So next week, we are going to officially announce this as part of Spiral. On Wednesday night of next week, we're having a public event at 6 p.m. here at PB. So anyone who's in the Bay Area, who's interested in AI, interested in learning more about Goose, or if you're already familiar with Goose, just learning what we're planning to do in more detail and hear directly from the engineers, not just myself, please check out that event. It's on the Presidio Bitcoin Luma website.
It's great.
Yeah. Okay, DK, what question do you have about GDK?
So GDK, it's kind of this abstract development kit. If you mentioned things like tool calling or calling different AI models, so am I, as a somebody who might be interested to build something on that, would I be going off and getting a key, like an API key from an AI model provider or an API key from a tool calling provider, like a search service or something? And I'd be bringing those to GDK to sort of use GDK as the orchestrator of those keys for me?
Yeah. I mean, GDK is going to have two API services. One already exists, and that's ACP, which is a emerging standard that's not from the Goose project, but I think ZAI created it, and it's being adopted. I think it's adopted by both Anthropic and OpenAI. Goose has adopted it. In fact, the team just completed the transition of the Goose desktop client from its own sort of proprietary REST interface to ACP. Hmm. So when we say GDK, there's two interfaces. One is ACP. The other is the Rust API. And I think you as a developer who want to build your own client, you just need to decide, do you want to embed the agent within your application? And if yes, use the Rust API. Whereas if you want to run it as a separate, if you want to run the agent as like a separate daemon and service, then you can use ACP. And, you know, it depends on your application needs. There's no right or wrong answer. It depends on what your needs are. I think the Rust API will also be lower level than ACP. So give you a little bit more fine-grained tunability and hooks into the agent loop. Because definitely in some early discussions with potential users, they, especially like AI startups, they need that finer grained control, lower level access. And I think the Rust API will meet their needs. Now, another thing that we haven't talked about, and I talked about the desktop application, that's not going away. It's still going to exist. There's a little bit of a pivot for it, though, in that it's going to be framed as the Goose reference client. Because again, there won't just be one Goose application. There'll be an ecosystem of dozens, hundreds, maybe even thousands of client applications built on GDK.
Geese, you might say.
Geese, thank you. Lots of fun puns we can have. So the one delivered from the core team and from the Linux Foundation and AIF will be the reference client. So what you should expect from that application is one that always reflects the latest and greatest API and reflects the best practices for using that API. That's what the reference client should deliver. The other thing the reference client will deliver, or so then we have to decide, okay, who's the user of this reference client? And the current thinking is that it will be a power tool for power users. That's what it's intended for. So you can expect to see more and more power features built in, such as you can kind of think of it as like web tools is in Chrome browser. Like if you just, anyone using a browser, you don't have to go use web tools. Most people probably aren't even aware of it. But if you click through and open up web tools, you get all this insight and observability into what's going on in the browser. That's the type of functionality we'd want to deliver in the reference client for Goose, where you know what's going on. And we've heard from many users of agents that agents today lack that kind of debuggability and observability. So if we can deliver on that, I think that'll be a go-to for power users of agents. But it's not going to try to be everything to everyone. Like if you're like a 6,000 person enterprise organization that want to deeply integrate your agent with all your data sources and all your tools internally, using the reference client as itself is probably not the right answer. And in fact, Block itself has developed a new client application on top of GDK for the company's own needs. And that's distinct from the Goose reference client. And I think we'll see that throughout many other organizations.
It also strikes me there's an interesting opportunity for people listening to this. You know, you talked about Anthropic and OpenAI having their own forward deployed engineers. Obviously, Goose is not going to do that. You'll build products and maybe Block will ship actual customer-facing products. But there's a huge opportunity in the same way like WordPress, right? Like, you know, is this open source blogging framework. There is a whole army of people that were getting paid to go help people set up their WordPress. I feel like there's a big opportunity for people that want to help businesses. And I think most businesses maybe that are doing OpenAI or Claude haven't really thought through the implications of what if this gets frozen? What if my data gets leaked? What if they build a competitor with my data, which is something I know we'll talk more about. And so, you know, one beautiful outcome would be that this creates a lot of opportunity, a lot of jobs, entrepreneurial type jobs for people to go and help roll their custom stack with GDK for specific businesses, small, large, whatever.
Totally agree. 100%. For sure. A related topic, well, I'm happy to answer any other questions you have about Goose, GDK, Spiral working on it. But we'll probably talk more next week as well after our announcements and stuff. But a related topic is Buzz. So we could,
yeah.
You ready to talk about Buzz?
DK? Yeah. So I was going to ask. I use Buzz every day. I assume Buzz is a GDK? Type of a client built on top of GDK. Is that right?
Well, so Buzz
uses ACP, right?
It uses ACP exactly. So yes, you can. If you already have a Goose client installed on your computer, Buzz automatically detects that and uses it. And And similarly, though, if you have like Claude Code or Codex installed, it recognizes that. And that's actually a great demonstration of the power of the ACP emerging standard.
Yeah, I'm right
there. And that you can have any of those installed or all of those installed, and they just automatically work with Buzz, and it's a pretty seamless experience. I mean, within Buzz, you can pick one or more agents that you want to use, some of which you might want to share, and you know, and they can run these different models.
Yeah, I actually I have Codex and Claude app on my Mac OS, and I use Buzz with ACP to control each of them. But then I think I tried, I don't use anti-gravity, which is Google's kind of harness, but I think I have anti-gravity, and I think I tried using it with ACP, and it is not supporting. So I'm wondering, is that maybe an explicit choice, like kind of a defensive strategic measure, or do you think they just haven't gotten around to it, or what's the story with Google and ACP?
Max?
No idea. Probably they haven't gotten around to it.
We need JamChat to rescue us here. No, I don't have the matrix embedded in my head of who supports it, who doesn't, what their strategic views are. I have no idea. I just know that Goose, Anthropic, and OpenAI all support it, and it seems to work well.
Well, so and maybe this is a good jumping point for this as well. DK, I'm curious, you've been using Fable recently, and I'm curious to hear how you've been using it, what you've been building with it. I think we should talk about Fable as well, all the drama that's gone down. But one question I have as you're building, why are you choosing to use Buzz as the harness for these, for Codex or Claude Code, instead of just doing it directly in Claude Code or Codex?
Oh yeah, that's easy. So, and we talked about this on the show maybe 6 months ago. A common workflow that I use is I 6 months ago before I was using Buzz, is I would prompt something and then I would kind of feel like I wanted to get a second opinion on it.
Nice.
And so I would ask whatever agent, I'd be like, package this up into a summary of the decisions or questions or open issues so that I can copy and paste it into another client, another LLM that can evaluate it. And so I would do that as a checkpoint and then copy and paste it over to the other one, have it give its feedback and advice, and then I'd bring that advice packaged back up to the first one. And so I spent a lot of time. I even suggested maybe a solution would be create a file system with like a shared document that could be written out to help with this kind of coordination. The thing that brings me to Buzz every day is that I actually have a Codex in Buzz. I have a Claude in Buzz. I have a Fable separate from my Claude in Buzz. So my thing I call Claude is actually running Opus 4.8. I have a separate agent that runs Fable. And so I can dynamically call whichever agent I want to do whatever kind of work I want. So I don't have to be fixed in one interface that ties sort of one family of agents, like all of the Claude agents, right? I can use Buzz and say, okay, Codex, do this. Okay, Claude, do this. Okay, now I want to bring in Fable to do this.
I love that.
Very easily address them, just like I'm addressing somebody in Slack.
And it makes tons of sense to me that you would want this sort of council of experts. I think this reminds me of a conversation we had with Pablo a year or so ago, and the idea of the boardroom or your own personal board of advisors. But you could have, because in theory, you could have not just the different companies, right? But you could have like different fine-tuned models that maybe have specific context that
prompt. You can set in Buzz, you set it up with a persona. So you set up a prompt and you say, like, I have this set up, like, Claude, you're going to do all of the creative decisions, all the design. I want you to do no building, or primarily don't focus on actual writing of code.
That's cool.
But focus on all the design, the trade-offs, and the features, and focus on getting to a really good spec. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to have Codex. I want you to tag Codex in. So I actually have them going right now. Literally, I didn't realize I don't usually do this podcast with my computer unconnected to power, but I've done it. Now I've been running agents the whole time and it's drawing down quickly. So I might have to take a bathroom break.
Yeah, I'll join you.
pull a Max Web.
I'll just talk about the World Cup by myself.
But they're going right now. Yeah, I've got Claude finishes a cycle of building or of specking, and then it passes it off. It tags Codex in directly in line. Codex wakes up in response to that and starts building the thing, and then it finishes building and says, here's where I am, and it tags Claude back. And Claude, so they've been going this whole time. I've got actually two different projects actually happening while we're recording the show.
Okay, this is amazing. I have a ton to say about this. My first thought is, one, I would love to see your setup. So if you can share like your prompts that you have for each
of these. We added you to Buzz.
Well, I know, but
you can literally join this channel.
So I can see, but can I see it?
Yes.
Like the actual prompts you use to set up your agents?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So a really important thing that...
The prompts to set up the agents you can't see. Yeah, I would have to show you that separately.
This is what I was going to get at. I should join your new channel, but I think it would be really powerful when you do release this to the public to show people...
It is released to the public.
Oh, it is?
It's open source.
Oh, I didn't realize it was
DK
live.
Is not a Block employee.
Well, I know, but DK was an early tester. Anyways, one thing that I would find very valuable, I think a lot of people would be to like see like, how do you do this, right? And so it's one thing that's very obvious to say, plug in OpenAI, plug in Claude. Okay, great. But also I think this idea of having the different personas and like having models that focus on different tasks, like making it as explicit as possible. Maybe this gets built in the product later. Like here's a suggestion of like, you know, you want this to be your design agent. Here's the kind of prompt I use for that. I think that would be super valuable. I would like to see that.
Think it actually does something like this out of the box. Now, I haven't done the onboarding recently, but I think there is something in onboarding which coaches you toward that. And to be honest, I'm actually not using, I think there's infrastructure within Buzz that supports that kind of agent persona customization. And I think that's actually a feature. And I think I haven't actually even used that feature as much as I've documented. I told my agent to behave in a certain way and I just told it to like document it so that it wakes up every session that way. So it kind of does it without using the feature, but the feature, you know, is probably very easy to use. I just haven't. The UI has gotten reworked and I haven't dug into it.
Just real quick, another thing you've not yet emphasized, DK, is the multi-human player aspect of Buzz, too. Mm-hmm. There's the multi-AI agent player, but there's also human. And so, like, you literally can just go in and observe and lurk everything he's doing.
Well, hopefully not all of his channels. Not sure.
Well, I mean, a channel, I mean, like Discord or Slack, you can private, public, you can invite people or... You know, you can choose the scope, but assuming you have access to a channel, you can lurk, you can engage, you can participate, and
you can prompt my agents.
Yeah, because you can share agents, right?
Okay.
So
Cypher Pedro, you are in the ONT channel, right?
Yeah.
You can go in that channel and you can be like, at Chat Lunatique, which is the name of the Claude. Or of the Codex agent, you get to name your agent. So come up with fun.
Wait.
I have at Fabulist, well, for the least. But you can, can tag it, right?
Man
you
of culture, it. I say.
I don't think about World Cup, but I can say things sort of Frenchy. you can tag these agents, and you can. And you can ask them. You could be like, hey, catch me up. What is DK doing with this project? Where are we? What are the decisions to be made? You can literally, Max, you can be the person who goes in there in this collaborative environment and ask my agents what the heck is going on, and it will tell you.
Okay, so I have a ton of different questions and ideas around this. My next one is, do you have any open source agents in there, and why not if you don't?
I don't have any open source agents in there right now. I like playing with the frontier models, you know, like I like playing with Fable and Opus 4.8. I wanted to get, you have to set up infrastructure to run these things or sign up for a new account. And there's like stuff you have to do and it hasn't been a priority for me. I'm like interested in it, you know, theoretically, but I just haven't had a need to push towards it yet.
And then where is the actual data stored right now? So for all of your, say, like your chats,
you're gonna love this,
and the code that you generate, where is it?
You're gonna love this.
Yeah, tell me.
Nostra.
What do you think? Yeah. It's true.
Well, I'm assuming you're not storing all the outputs of your code on a Nostra relay.
All of them.
Are you being serious?
Seriously.
But there's no way that's cost effective.
I mean, it's a database.
Yeah, but like, so that's awesome. We should talk about why Nostra is being used.
I think we talked about this before on the show at Buzz, how it works. Yeah. I mean, it uses Nostra, but you can back it with a SQL database.
Okay.
You don't have to publish it out to Domus and Primer. You can just run it on your own. You can run your own relay with your own database, right?
So Block is using Buzz internally.
Yeah.
They have Nostra relays, but they're using,
which is badass, by the way.
But they're using like just a standard, highly efficient, durable SQL database to store the data for the enterprise. And so other enterprises can do that as well. But is it like you can imagine an open source project,
yeah,
where all of a sudden you want the decentralized distributed nature of Nostr. Well, then, you know, each contributor or some subset of contributors can run their own Nostr relay and have their own copy of the data.
Okay, this is exciting for so many reasons, but just so I'm clear on this. So, and I think this is beautiful, as I've been saying for a very long time to a lot of people who are like, oh, you know, Nostr, this chat stuff is boring. It's like, dude, the chat stuff is nothing. It's nothing. Just like forget there was even Twitter clones in the first place. Agents with their own identities that can post to like decentralized infrastructure for the web, now we're cooking. So that's exciting in and of itself. But to be clear, the way I always kind of envision it, well, I guess first question, are these Nostr relays like public? Can I, or the ones that Block is running for this?
One of the developers at the company is like hosting his own public relay for us to play with it. But I mean, that's just like a...
Once you get spammed,
That's a stopgap. You know, they did that to enable DK to do it because he's not a Block employee.
Yeah.
And also just do a test for like people outside the company using it. You always find problems that...
Yeah, love it.
There's like assumptions internally. But I mean, that's just temporary. I mean, eventually there'll be, you know, a solution.
So to be clear,
that's more scalable.
The reason I'm asking this is, if you'll recall a few episodes, we talked about all the developments on Nostr. One of the things I'm really excited about is you're starting to see insight in the sort of decentralized web hosting infrastructure, which I think is a really big deal that everyone's asleep on. By the way, I've launched, if you guys didn't see, I made a birthday page for Roy, my dog, and it's amazing because it's not hosted.
I thought you meant Roy from Breeze.
Yeah, well, if he has a birthday, happy birthday to him too. I'll send it to you guys again. It's an insight. So there is no, I didn't pay for any hosting. But what's critical is the way the insight standard works is, and this is the way I've always kind of envisioned Nostr, is that Nostr is like the message board. Nostr is where you say, you know, okay, I need to find, you know, whatever, Steve Lee's connection. I need to connect with him or with DK or whatever. Nostr is where like connections can happen, like keys can find each other. But like the, you know, and the Nostr relay stores some text. But like if you want to start storing beefier, like let's say you want to store, like in this case for a website, I have actual like images I want on the website, right? And so those mm-hmm. files get really fat. So that's where Nostr then is sort of in unison with something like Blossom Server, which is more, you can think of it kind of like an IPFS, more of like a like Mint for large data storage. The two of them together, the Nostr relay is there to point one, you know, piece of code for a website to an actual piece of data, which is stored in the Blossom servers. Is that what the ultimate vision is? Is like there's going to be something else that's actually storing the heavy data? Or you think that the Nostr relays themselves can just swell and store everything?
I would think of it more like the whole idea of using Nostr is decoupling the application from a server or a backend.
Yes.
It's just decoupling that.
Agreed.
Now, what you choose to do with decoupled, that's up to you. You can choose your own application.
Really enough.
Yeah. If you have like a picture of Roy that you think is likely to be censored, then maybe you choose Blossom. Okay. Because Blossom can help you with some of that resilience against censorship. But right. If you're like, look, I have an AWS account or a GCP account or Azure, I'm just going to push Roy up there. And I don't think he's a spicy guy. You know what I mean? Then you use it that way. So it's really about selection and choice and openness.
Right. Okay, fair.
It doesn't couple the front end to the back end.
Yeah,
major. And then you can use Blossom if you want, but it's sort of application specific.
How much have you guys tested having these agents have Nostr identities, being able to interact with the rest of the Nostr ecosystem? So as an example, some of your guys from one of your channels being able to go out there and like, whatever, make a post that Primal could render. Have you tried anything like that yet?
I haven't tried that. I assume these are not kind one messages, and they're also in like a
isn't
separate,
everything kind one message?
Well, I assume they're overloaded in some ways that may not render nicely, but I don't know.
Sounds like a good experiment for Max to try.
Yeah.
I just want to point out, Matt has a comment here. Just the ability to watch other people build is amazing and something lacking from every other vibe coding tool. Yeah. Totally agree. And in fact, one observation I've had recently, open source software development, one tenet of open source software development is like working in public mm-hmm. and like having your work be done in public. So discussions about, you know, approaches to a change you want to make, and then you open a PR, a pull request. And then anyone in the world can look at that code change, comment on it, critique it. And it's just very transparent compared to typical corporate software development. However, it's not typically public until the PR is opened. So as an individual developer, you might have a concept, then you might code up a prototype on your computer that only you can see. Then you might go through debugging cycles and find a bunch of bugs, fix them. You might write test vectors. You might rewrite the code. You do all this development before you open the pull request. And even open source developers, you know, you take pride in your work and you have a higher bar typically for until you want to share it with others to, because if you share something too early in that culture of opening a pull request, you can be considered wasting other people's time. But with Buzz, you literally are working in public from inception. Because
it's cool.
It's your choice, but I believe this is the future of software development in general, and certainly open source development.
Even if it's closed source, you still need this kind of collaboration within whatever group is closed. So I think it's just the future of software development is this.
So from the get-go, you're prompting and it's shared and others can lurk or engage. Then related to that, another observation I had is that probably most of us have a bunch of apps on our phone, some of which are like super popular apps of millions of users, like Google Apps and, you know, Messenger and stuff like that. But everyone has a bunch of apps that are like much smaller scale. They're from small businesses or small organizations. Like I went on this camping trip recently and they had an app
for the camp,
right? And then like my local fitness center has an app. Now, in both of these cases, you can imagine this app was probably created 8 or 10 years ago. They probably contracted out to some company to do it, and then it hasn't been touched since. And you can tell that when you use it because it looks like it.
Yeah. Ever tried parking at the Presidio?
Oh, actually, I just had someone yesterday struggle with that for 20 minutes.
It's pretty janky. Yeah. It's, you know, and there's just all kinds of low-hanging fruit, which as a user of it, you're just like frustrated. It's like, oh, why don't they make this UI change or add this feature or remove this feature or what have you? Imagine a world in which the development of such an app for small businesses, in which there's tens and tens of hundreds of millions of small organizations that either have or could or should have a website or an app. And imagine being able to go to a Buzz channel and actually make a change yourself.
I love it.
So I really believe this is the future.
And you make the change in English.
Yeah, that's sick.
Yeah, it's accessible to everyone to make the change. The main blocker or challenge of that is you still need some kind of gatekeeper. You can't just like literally have willy-nilly anyone can make a change to an app because you can have malicious usage. You can have, it's not consistent with the architecture, not consistent with the design, et cetera. So you need some kind of gatekeeper, but this gatekeeper can undoubtedly be 95% AI with a little bit of human effort. And so I think there'll be this is so valuable for these small organizations that they will need to change to have a human gatekeeper along with AI. But I think that's the future.
Okay. So I agree with all of that. And I would go even further. Like I actually think there's going to be even less gatekeeping than that. And there will still be some, but you know, I was having a really fascinating discussion with a good friend I haven't talked to in a long time about a lot of things, AI, software, Bitcoin stuff, which actually we should talk about. There's a deflation question I think is interesting. But the big takeaway is he was like, I'm very bullish on open source. And I was like, well, I don't know about the software. I think where we all landed and concluded is open protocols are about to be the most important thing. And this is why I remain extremely bullish, not only on Bitcoin, but on Nostr and potentially other stuff. Like I'm not as deep on ACP or whatever, but like you say that every organization needs its own app. Well, why? Every organization needs a set of requirements or standards to do a thing, but then each of us can render our own version of that app, right? Like imagine parking the Presidio. All they need to really set is, hey, here's some rules that have to be respected in your app. You can park between these hours. Here's the payment we want. Beyond that, knock yourself out. And so once you have, you know, particularly an identity, an open identity standard, potentially an OSTR, open data transmission standard, I think it's going to be an OSTR still, an open payment standard, hopefully Bitcoin in the background, then like there's no reason each of us can't, like, why do we even need apps at all? Like if I'm sitting there on my phone, I'm just like, hey, real time, render me a UI to like handle this like parking situation, or even better, just do it for me, maximize the time for the minimum cost. If I need an app, spin up a UI, otherwise just do it. And we can all have our different versions.
Chat is basically the last interface that we humans will have to the internet.
I agree. Except I do think there will be, I think you'll get custom UIs for certain things. Like if you want to like have a slider to change the color, but then you can imagine one day when we have Google Glass again or contacts or just like, you know, just like pops up, mess with it, done.
But it can generate that UI for you on the fly.
On the fly.
Just the controls you need, not all the extra junk.
100%. Like we're there. And so what's left, open source is still super important. It's just the open protocol for identity and data, and that's it.
Yeah.
Which is why long Nostra, as always.
And so dovetailing on Steve's comment about, so it used to be that in open source software, any software, you merge things in and you kind of only see it as they get merged. So there's sort of maybe every week or two. When you're in a chat context, everything's happening real time, right? So whatever I'm chatting, if I'm exploring a hypothesis, everybody can see the hypothesis. They understand that it's just a hypothesis, but they can see kind of my train of thought. And they could try to even reconstruct it. They could have the LLM reconstruct it for me. So there's all kinds of new things that happen in software and in how we collaborate on software when we kind of move it from kind of every once in a while periodic check-in and publish thing to kind of an always real-time chat thing. Another thing that has surfaced from using Buzz a lot is that I think we still don't really understand how to, like, we're so limited in how we can process information compared to how these machines can process information that we keep kind of applying the old models of how we used to process information, and we keep trying to bring those into this new thing. And I think there's actually tons of opportunity to rethink that. So simple example, when I run into a problem on Buzz, there's a Buzz feedback channel, and you can write up a issue that you want the team to consider, think about. And I was sort of having my Claude agent file things into that channel. And I think so far that channel gets read by humans. So in a sense, it's like kind of information overload to send all this stuff from my agent. Doesn't take me a lot of work to do, but there are real bugs and issues to send those to the feedback channel. And then if there's humans reading on the other side, it's just too heavy. So we need a new system where it's not humans reading on the other side, but the humans have agents listing and prioritizing. And so in a sense, all of the software assumptions that are baked into something like a GitHub, like how we collaborate on software, is all this like async periodic thing instead of a always on real time, like water flowing kind of thing. I think it's just going to reset our relationship with, you know, human attention and how limited it is, but don't be constrained by our habits. Rebuild new habits in a world where agents can actually process and prioritize information for us and surface the things that actually need our attention.
I love that. But again, all of this to me comes back to the most important thing is keeping the protocols open and the identity user-owned because, and the ability to switch. And I guess this is where GDK becomes super important between models, because I think it's very easy to see the nightmare scenario where, oh man, this is so powerful. And then you get trapped in one provider and like all of a sudden it gets cut off. I think, one experience I want to report that I'm curious what your experience has been with Fable. I think we should at least touch on Claude, you know, this case of this.
Before we move on, can I give one more use case I wanted to share with Buzz that I think is the future? I think any project that is an SDK or offers an API, today they commonly, that a project like that will have a Discord, a community around Discord. I think in the future, the community will be Buzz for those SDKs. And then anyone building on that API can just open up a channel in that community. And everyone, again, it's just like we just talked about, but everyone can then lurk or participate in the usage of that API. It'll completely change developer support too. If you're responsible for the API and DK and I are building our own apps, you're going to see how we're building it.
Yeah.
You and your agents can then provide developer support to us if we're not following best practices or if there's like good suggestions.
Totally.
I think that's the future for all SDKs and APIs as well.
I love it. Yeah. So the point that I wanted to make, maybe switching a bit to talking about Claude, and I got very Claude-pilled. I would say around December, I started using actually Google a lot more, and then maybe January, February, started using Claude a lot more, and I've been like pretty dedicated to Claude ever since. I just felt like it was much better. I did some sort of coding tasks, but mostly I was just using it for like my own research, thinking partner, et cetera. What I will report is I haven't tried Fable again since it came back out, so I'm excited to do that this weekend. Although I'm skeptical that it's the same Fable. It's almost certainly not. But I noticed Google had been actually much more helpful for me. I'm working on like a big LP update right now. And so I was discussing some changes I needed to make. And Google has given me really good feedback. What I've noticed is that Claude over time, in my experience, has become more and more paternalistic. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. But even though it's extremely powerful, it kept being more like, well, you shouldn't say that. That's like a little, you know, like one example, someone was suggesting me some, let's say, alternative ideas around metabolic health and this like stuff with like structured water, which whatever is more controversial. Claude's like, oh, that's a lot of hooey. And Google is much more like, well, you know, it's a controversial topic. Here are both sides. Where like, it's like, Claude, I don't want you moralizing me and telling me what's hooey or not, right? And I'm hearing more people are saying things like, hey, it's getting late. You should probably go to bed. It's like, fuck are you, Claude? Like, sit down. And so anyways, so I've gotten a little bit more frustrated with Claude recently, and then I feel like it's maybe going a bit more in the direction of, you know, trying to moralize. Google actually less so. And so that's just one example of the way that you can sort of like the frog boiling. I loved it. And over time, I'm noticing it serve my interest, at least with research and the way I want to be a free thinker less and less. I'm curious your sort of experience, because obviously at the coding frontier, they've been just dominating with Fable or with Mythos Fable. And I'm hearing another interesting topic is like internally that their next version's already out. And so one could argue that Anthropic's already
beyond Fable.
Yeah, beyond Mythos. Yeah. And that I think that's another interesting topic is that for better or for worse, even though all this open source stuff is cool and it's going to be great for us as humans, like if they've already reached recursive self-improvement, they may have already won the whole battle. That's an interesting thing. I'm curious your take on. But now that Fable's back, you know, are you liking it? Are you noticing any issues that it's more, even more paternalistic since it's been re-released? How do you make sure, I guess, since you're using something like Buzz, you're not going to get trapped in there, even if it is more powerful? Yeah. What is your experience?
I mean, I haven't been using it. Like, I haven't written prose much. Like, your LP update is more prose. I've been using it mostly for software development projects. And then I mentioned the treasure hunt. So I've been using it to help me with kind of puzzles, right? Mm-hmm. And in those contexts, I haven't found it to be super paternalistic. I mean, sometimes it does err on the side of, you know, kind of safety type stuff. But, you know, I can easily tell it, let's not worry about that for now. We'll get to that later. Let's defer it. And meaning when you're trying to build something, if it thinks you're deploying it to a million people and you're just sort of building a little hack project, it's like a different standard of what you need to do. But I've found it not to be a problem, but I do, you know, I do worry about the future of how these things are. And if you get locked in, and I don't worry that Anthropic has some sort of like recursive self-improvement that nobody else is going to match and they're just going to dominate everything. Like, it's possible.
Why not?
Well, I think the techniques that they're using are the same techniques that OpenAI is using. They all have really good researchers. I think, you know, I think DeepMind has got really good researchers. So I don't think that there's one that is in a position that's like obviously going to just leapfrog everybody else. They're going to be constrained by data and compute and energy and chips.
Just to push back on that, I mean, although it's a little bit of a side note, like in theory, even if let's say one lab has an edge that's only a month, they're like, it's pretty small and like everyone will in theory get there. But if you really are recursive self-improvement pilled, and so the idea behind recursive self-improvement is that once you have a good enough model, you know, increasingly automates more and more of its own development until it automates all the development of the next model. So you have, you know, whatever Mythos creates the next one. Well, no, I'm saying that maybe some folks listening haven't thought about this before. And so,
but they're still constrained by compute.
Well,
like compute is limited.
They were
self improvement. you have a compute constraint, right?
Well, they were until they signed the partnership with Elon, right? And so in the long run, that's still why I'm bullish that I think X is going to
lose. I think if you have recursive self-improvement, there's not enough compute for you.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't care if you have space. There's not enough compute. We just haven't built enough.
Yeah.
So if you've actually solved that problem and you're so far ahead of everybody else, you're still constrained by the physical world. And, you know, how you allocate, it's not like a GPU is not a GPU is not a GPU, like which harnesses it's in, which agents it's in. Like there's all kinds of details to that. Like look at Meta, I think they had their Gemini usage cut off. Like Google said, we're not going to let you use this much Gemini because there's like a compute constraint.
Yeah.
And it's like
reasonable.
At the same time, Meta is reselling some of their compute infrastructure that's unused because they don't have enough demand for what they built out. So in a sense, these things are not like fungible. It's not, I mean, if that were the case, you could just say, well, Meta, why don't you just contribute your compute so that Gemini can run that and then you can actually buy as much as you want. And it's like, they're just not all as fungible as you imagine, but there's definitely a constraint. Right. And the constraint is why any given recursive self-improvement thing, you get a month ahead, that doesn't really mean that you've dominated the whole space because there's at least three US-based labs that are all very credible, really top research teams that are kind of pushing the frontier. And, you know, they can leapfrog each other, but I think they're doing a really good job. And then there's all the Chinese models that appear to be doing a really close follow on a lot of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that the compute constraint is going to keep things in check for a minute. But like once you have robots that are controlled by the AIs, I don't think that's going to hold much longer, which by the way, this
is
my
that like months out in your mind, or is that like years?
I mean, it's probably years out, but like, I think it's hard to predict, to be honest, like how quickly this is going to go. And if it really does come down to that, then I still think either China or X, Elon is going to be able to jump back ahead. Because if it's really about who can control the robots, well, there's really like two parties that are building robots at scale that I know of. And if it's really about the power, there's two parties that have a lot of power. Unless, you know, you think that maybe OpenAI and Anthropic are so far ahead of the others as like a duopoly that the other guys are kind of forced to pick and partner, in which case it seems like both Google and X are pointing more of their physical largesse towards Anthropic, which would bode pretty well for them. So I don't know.
Yeah, but there's still like, there's not one org that runs away with everything. Everybody's kind of in a little bit of a Mexican standoff to some extent.
Yeah.
So it's also NVIDIA, TSMC.
Yeah. That's true.
All the energy players.
So. For now, unless someone gets both an algorithm recursive lead and enough hardware that and control of the robots that they can start robots creating their own robots. Which
over a decades period for sure, but like it's just going to lot to happen within those decades. Who owns what assets and who controls what decisions and choke points and stuff. So
I would just say things can happen faster than you think. Like probably not on the order of months, but I think decades is way too long. Like I think probably on the order.
Well, I'm agreeing decades because it's an easy thing to agree with. I'm not saying that's my prediction.
Yeah.
Anyways. I'm saying you're right on that time frame for sure.
I'm going to go with yours.
Should we, let's switch gears to OpenUSD was announced this past week.
This is, I thought it was called Libre or something like that. Libre 2.0.
Well, original Libre was
it is kind of a, Libre,
a basket of currencies.
Yeah. I'm saying that tongue in cheek.
This is just US dollars.
Yeah.
But, this was announced, I think Stripe kind of spearheaded it. But it's a new stablecoin issuance, OUSD. And it's a very impressive set of logos and brands and companies behind it.
It's like literally everyone except for Circle and Tether.
Well, no Block.
No Block, that's true.
No Nubank. And no Robin Hood. No PayPal.
Oh, wow.
No Circle, no Tether.
Yeah.
Pretty much
everybody else.
Pretty much everybody else.
Yeah.
Including Coinbase.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Now, so what is, well, it appears to be a response to Tether and USDC. I think a lot of the incumbent fintech companies, because to be clear, it includes Visa and MasterCard.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Yeah. And Amex and Discover, I think.
Yeah. So the traditional powerhouses are all behind this, and likely they all feel
I'm still here, but I'm going to plug in my computer. So keep
going. Okay, cool. They likely all feel threatened by the potential of Tether and USDC. Maybe more. Both. Maybe more USDC, but certainly both.
Yeah.
Reasonable to feel threatened by that. So this appears to be a response to that. And one thing that they reported, which is a differentiator, is how the profits of the dollars held in treasuries are distributed. With Tether, they're distributed to Tether. Very profitable business.
Yeah.
With Circle, it's distributed to Circle and Coinbase. And those companies can cut deals with distribution partners, but it's, you know, they certainly get the lion's share of the profits. And with OUSD, though, the issuers, there's no issuers that take the profits. The profits are distributed to those who are providing value and distribution. And I don't know the exact formula and how that is accounted for and works, but, you know, so if Visa is doing an insane number of transactions and has a crazy number of customers, they're going to get their part of the pie.
Right.
Which
makes sense.
Which makes sense and is certainly a more fair system, a more incentive aligned system, which is probably the better way to frame it in terms of this working in capitalism than Tether or USDC. So it seems like they have a leg up in that. And then just the sheer number of companies and power behind those companies is a leg up. What we don't know, though, is like how much of this was like a company was contacted within the past week and said, hey, I want to put my logo on this.
Yeah.
Versus like companies have implemented this and are deploying it and marketing it, and pushing it onto their customers. We don't know yet. But it does seem like with all these different like stablecoin standards, like this does seem like it has the greatest potential and could be a big threat to USDC and Tether as a competitor and perhaps even winner take all.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me.
On top of GQL.
Built on top of GQL.
Is it?
I don't know.
No, but Google's on there.
But yeah, Google's part of it. And so
it's kind of aligned with that idea, right?
I agree. Google, and for those that don't know what GQL is, we talked about it last summer when Google announced it.
Steve was the original GQL maximalist.
I'm a G. I love. I think GQL is the right tool for this job.
Yeah.
Don't use a blockchain for this. Use Google Cloud Universal Ledger. It's far more efficient, way more economical. Provides compliance out of the box, which you need for something like a US dollar payment rails and money. And you get, you know, Google is a credibly neutral player and has a long track record of having good uptime and stuff. So I think it's a great solution for that. It's just wholly unlike Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Like Bitcoin's very different.
Well, so I have a couple of thoughts on this. My first thought is I think this really validates a lot of what we've been saying forever about open standards. To be clear, what this is, it's OpenUSD, that's the name, OUSD?
OpenUSD, but it's only as open as OpenAI is.
I see what you're doing.
It's way more open than OpenAI.
It's not a single company. It's like dozens of companies. But
because they created a new company.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's very, it's Visa-like.
It's like Visa.
The Visa.
I'm just saying the word open. Don't get too attached to the word open.
It's a consortium and Visa was more like a cooperative in a way, which is like, you know, you own what you do, which is what these is aiming for. In general, I think it's pretty reasonable. Like, I actually kind of like the idea. But what I want to stress is two things. Number one, this is them agreeing on a standard for a stable coin, not a rail. And that's a big point. Because my first thought was, oh shit, because I made this point in the past. And I was like, am I going to have to walk this back? I'm like, there's no world in which Stripe and Adyen are ever going to cooperate on some crypto thing. And I was like, oh shit, this says Stripe and Adyen. Like, what did I miss? I was like, okay, well, this is for the stable coin where each of them will get, you know, whatever, the treasury payments in accordance with the revenue that they drive in theory. But it doesn't mean that they're going to step away from Stripe using
Tempo
Tempo or you know, I think they're going to issue now on, was it Solana is the big one first. They're going to issue on a bunch of these other random, you know, as I've said in the past, shitcoin chains, and I stand by that.
Or G-Coin,
whatever.
Right. And so on base.
It does literally nothing to invalidate the point that, you know, we've collectively talked about and I've been screaming about in my updates for years, which is these are all the payment networks, not the asset. The asset, fine. They can, you know, that's competing with, you know, Circle's offering and Tether's offering. This is saying this is another, this is doing nothing to solve the problem. They're issuing this on like four or five different intranets. Ethereum, which is conspicuously absent from the list, we think. Interesting. Solana, Tron, G-Coin, Base, whatever. They are all intranets. They do not interoperate.
Spark and Bitcoin.
Well, to me, that was great, is that Lightspark was part of this. And I don't know any, I haven't spoken with them about this, but it would seem that they're in a really nice position given that they're the only one in that group that I know of that does connect back to Bitcoin and the Lightning Network and Spark, that potentially they're in a really nice position to be, again, taking this asset with huge potential and market making between all the intranets. But again, I just want to come back. This point is so damn important to me. All of the last 10 years of crypto development has nothing to do with, you know, Bitcoin or decentralization. Like, I stand by, the only thing any of these networks ever did was confuse regulators, and that's it. There was a way for them.
It's still just serving that function, right?
Yeah. But this is my point, is like all this stuff that was like crypto is like, what is, like, this is a new asset, which is just a US dollar. And they're all going to be issued on a bunch of networks, which are not decentralized.
I bet if you have an OUSD and it's all regulated and some of it is issued on Sol and some of it is issued on Polygon, on Base, that those will be interoperable by some centralized provider.
By who? By someone that can step in.
Stripe, Bridge.xyz.
Exactly. By someone that can step in.
The guy who runs it, the guy who founded Bridge?
Yeah. Zach Abrams.
The guy who
X Square.
Okay.
Yeah,
and what I'm saying is, I'm sure he'll do well. I'm sure that was part of their plan. But I think someone like Lightspark is even better positioned, at least from now, because they're also bridging into the world of like Tether on whatever Tron, or when Tether comes to, the Lightning Network, if it ever does. All of a sudden, like, my broader point is, whoever bridges to the most networks, and Bitcoin is the only thing that I know of that will bridge with everything, then they're in the best position to have the best market making.
But I think the OUSD could be a very seamless experience despite all of the potential intranetty looking things, because it's just the one OUSD. I think my guess is the way this came together is all these big financial powerhouses, and they have each been asking themselves, hey, should we launch our own stablecoin?
Yeah.
And they've done the analysis and said, I don't think we're going to beat, you know, Tether. But I think if they all come together as a network instead of as a single issuer, they could, and they can do a lot. They can do a lot of things that are really attractive. If, like, they could probably share, I don't think we have clarity yet, right? But they could share rewards back in certain ways without it being obviously illegal. So there's a lot of things you can do when you actually get a network that earns relative to their contributions different. You know, you could use that to beat the incumbent, and you could use it to play around with incentives in very, very different ways than we've seen yet.
Don't get me wrong, I think it's super smart. And by the way, my guess is this is much more of a threat to Circle than it is to Tether.
Yeah. Circle is down 20% the day it was announced.
So my guess is Circle only had a foothold at all because of regulatory issues with Tether in the United States. I actually do think Tether has such a strong network effect in emerging countries, like basically in Latin America and Africa, that it's going to still be hard to unseat them. Not impossible, but my guess is this new standard can win the majority of volume because the value weighted volume is probably in the United States and like whatever Western wealthy countries. Yeah. But I do think it's still going to be hard to unseat network effect that Tether has in Africa and Latin America and parts of Europe.
So, and I do think
agrees with you.
Coinbase and Circle, I think, are going to have to respond to the competitive pressure to maintain their USDC.
Well, Coinbase is already defected. I kind of feel bad for Circle.
I don't think Coinbase has a cash cow in USDC. Why would they just drop that at the hat and defect?
Why did they join?
Because they're why not? There's no cost to putting their logo on that.
Yeah.
But the issue is you only make revenue share of the treasury based on how you promote the network. I don't think it's been entirely discussed, but it's basically how much you drive usage of that, right? Whether it's holding or transaction.
If I'm in charge of Coinbase, I put my logo on it. I participate, I follow along, but I massively promote. I want USDC to win.
Right.
Because I get way more money that way.
Yeah.
And then, but if it loses, I want to hedge my bet. But also with OUSD, I don't really see how, I mean, you can just follow along too and join later. Like a new bank or Block or other companies that, if it takes off and gets adopted, sure. Or like, what about Toast, Clover, all these different payment solutions? They can just add support later.
They might grandfather in, like, there's like founding member extra privileges. To be interested, I'm curious the Block take on this, but my take when I read, and I did notice who was conspicuously absent, so like Nubank is one example. I assumed it's either because they want to issue their own stablecoin and they see that as a money-making opportunity and they don't want to like have to compete there. Or in the case of Block, like I assume Block doesn't want to issue a stablecoin at all. Or even like, I don't know. Actually, you would know better than me. What is the Block thinking on this?
I can't share the Block thinking on this.
Trying to get the alpha on the show, guys. Come on.
Can you hypothetically propose what Nubank might be thinking, Steve?
Yeah, exactly. Imagine Nubank was in the United States.
I think everybody who wants to launch their own stablecoin knows that it's futile. So either, participate with this one or wait and see if this takes off.
Well, okay. So why do you think Nubank might not be part of this?
I don't know enough about their business to really comment.
Speculation?
One is that I don't see much cost in taking a wait and see approach with OUSD. The main value in jumping on now is if somehow you mentioned like founding privileges or whatever, but there's like 160 logos, right? So which of those, is there like a top 10 or something that they get an advantage of being early? I heard something about like a governance model, with a dozen companies or something.
Staking.
So if there's advantage to being early and if you get into that insider group, well, that's a reason. But otherwise, just the wait and see strategy, it gives you option value.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think also it's not worth underplaying your point that we don't know what the hell this even means, that the logo's on there. And like these guys are all competitive. And like the fact they say they're going to play nicely, like the fact that Visa came together was kind of a minor miracle. And there's like a whole awesome book by this guy, D. Hawk, who created it called, I'm forgetting the name now, but it's like Something from Nothing or something along
those lines. You can also listen to the Acquired podcast episode on Visa. Oh. It's nice. A 4-hour episode.
Yeah,
I should tell you the whole.
You should listen story. Just listen to it on a walk. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's
I will.
Amazing story, and it's I think kind of what is playing out here again in a way.
Like, yes.
Yeah,
like I'm it's a different, big, but it's philosophically similar. I think
I'm a big fan of that guy. I mean, reading that book which he wrote, which I thought was more of a basically a philosophical treatise than a history of payments. So that was super cool. But like that was quite challenging to pull together, is my understanding. And so the fact that people have said they're going to do it, I don't know. Like we'll see, right? Let's see where this is a year
out. So we're kind of running tight on time. We said we might cover strategy. So can we give a few minutes to it, I guess? Some people are clamoring that we give an update on it. I
mean, hey. <I'm just kidding. laughs>
So I actually don't think there's a whole lot to update. I mean, the price has tanked for strategy the past few weeks, like when I was on vacation or whatever. Including their other equities, Stretch and Strife and others also are like massively depegged. I think they hit like 80 cents to the dollar or something like that.
70s.
70s, and they've bounced back a bit. I think on Monday of this week, Strategy announced some policy changes, which helped a little bit of rebound across those different securities. One thing they did, I think it was last year, they created a US dollar reserve. And I think it was originally something like, was it $2.5 billion?
Yeah.
And I think largely to appease investors and sentiment and narrative around like, regardless of the ups and downs of the value of Bitcoin, they've got a U.S. dollar reserve to match some period of time of their liabilities for paying out these dividends. And initially it was like two and a half years worth. Then they started spending those dollars and it was got it to less than $1 billion, including paying off some of their bond debt like a month, what, 3-4 weeks ago. That seemed a little strange to me because they're creating that dollar reserve made sense to me.
Yeah.
Even if you're a Bitcoin believer, there's a lot of investors who want to see that. And it generally makes smart treasury management sense to me.
Right.
And the last thing you want to do is sell in a bear market, sell your Bitcoin at a price that you consider at the trough versus during a bull market. And that also happens to coincide with a time when it's hard to like raise money through equity or debt or other means. So like, how are you going to pay the dividends? So it was odd to me that they drew down on that and the market seemed to negatively react to it. So I do like what they did this week is they corrected that. And now it's up to over, or they, I think it's over $2 billion again.
Yeah. Well, I think it's 2.5 again. I forget, or they maybe even added more, but what I think is important is, you know, and we actually had a discussion with some more knowledgeable folks than us about this. And what I always found kind of questionable, and I actually didn't like this, is he raised the money and said, this is our kind of buffer, the dollar reserve buffer. And it was implied, we're going to use this to be able to pay dividends in the case that, you know, we need to. And then he goes out and start using it for other things. I think they used it for a Bitcoin buy at some point, I think. And then they certainly used it for the debt, convertible debt buyback. And so I was like, well, that's cool. And like, it's fine you do that, but you called it one thing and then did another thing. And so I actually think this is one area I disagree with Saylor and I think was a misstep was he gave one set of guidance and then did something else. What I think he corrected now, to his credit, is now they put it at, I think, you know, a more formal resolution saying we're going to keep at least, I forget if it was 18 or 12 months, I forget the actual number of months, of cash payments for the debt and for the stretch payments, always in cash. And if we ever want to go below that, we need board consent. That is critical.
I think the policy is the minimum 12 months.
Yeah.
I think currently the $2.5 billion cover 17 months.
So that, but the key thing there is not just the amount of money, but it's now, if we ever want to go below 12 months, we need board consent. There's now a governance piece around that. I think that's awesome. Now the market has clarity. There is, you know, because I think before, you know, and I actually don't think Saylor did the wrong thing, but I think it's like, if you say one thing and do something else, that's not good. So now he has like some guardrails around what he can and can't do. The market loves that. I think that's great. I also think though, just to be clear, a bit of a kind of an interesting hot take. I actually think everyone that was like, oh, it's unraveling. It's like Tether or not Tether. some people say that about
Terra Luna.
Terra Luna. Yeah. That was also all bullshit. Like I think people like have no idea. They haven't actually looked at the numbers. Even at its worst, when it was down at 70 something cents, I was like, well, this is clearly a buy opportunity for individuals or a hedge fund that has a lot of money to come in. Like the dude had, in addition to whatever cash he had on hand, 30 years of Bitcoin. If the price of Bitcoin dropped another half, he has 15 years worth of Bitcoin to pay it. So I just don't think, I mean, obviously these things are reflexive. I guess you could have like a run that goes on a run and Bitcoin crashes forever. But I mean, that's super unlikely to me. And so I think people that were calling it Terra Luna were just frankly misinformed. And I think that was very hysterical.
Totally agree. I thought it was ridiculous.
It was super ridiculous. And I mean, you shared that one tweet where it's like, mute anyone that says that. I think it's like, honestly, they don't know what they're talking about. They were just wrong on that. I do think that it's awesome that Saylor now has some more governance around him. I do think it's awesome that he's given more guidance to the market, but this was never Terra Luna. And one other thing that's super important, he also, people forget this, it is not a deposit. With Terra Luna is, I have to pay you this back. It is not a deposit. He doesn't have to pay you back. In fact, in the documents, he doesn't even have to pay you the dividend, which is crazy, but people don't realize that. Obviously, it would tank his credibility if he didn't, but if he got in a bad enough spot, he doesn't have to pay the dividend. So it is nothing like a stablecoin deposit. It is, trying to keep an implied valuation, but it is not a one-for-one peg, which gives him a lot of levers to pull.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important to understand.
This negative reaction and sentiment the past few weeks with the price tanking by Bitcoiners is absolutely bizarre to me.
Yeah.
I really don't think they understand how it works. I've learned nothing in the past few weeks that changes my view.
Yeah, I agree.
Where my understanding view, which I'm always open to correcting.
Yeah.
So if people have additions, please share with us.
Yes.
But the only bankruptcy scenario that I'm aware of is long-term.
Yes.
If the price of Bitcoin is flat to down over like 5 to 7 year type of period, then the entire strategy is in jeopardy,
yes,
and could fall apart.
And I think it's actually worth noting, the only way that even happens, and this is why I think Saylor got a little bit ahead of his skis here, I actually think he was trying to play 5D chess and it backfired on him, is even in that world, the only way that happens with an 80% drawdown that stays there for 5 years is if he keeps the convertible notes, because he has to make those payments. Right, he has whatever it is, like $8 billion now, or eight that's now down to $7 or $6 billion. I forget the exact numbers on the convertible debt. But the key thing is that's the only payment he has to make. So the only way this whole thing unravels is if Bitcoin is in the bear market you describe for an extended period of time, and he keeps the convertible debt, which is why I think he was trying to retire the convertible debt. Because once he does that, then he can say there's no scenario, because he doesn't have to contractually make the stretch payments. I know this sounds like a lot, and it sounds, you know, complicated. I get why people think it's scammy, but like, it's worth like doing a deep dive and understanding what he contractually has to do.
And you can imagine in a bull market, when they're in a stronger position, the ability to pay off all that debt, then they're in a very, very strong position.
Yeah, it's
gonna I mean, there are other failure scenarios. There could be fraud or
Coinbase gets hacked.
Horrible execution or Coinbase hacked. I mean, there's all those as well.
Yeah.
But assuming the execution is consistent with the strategy,
yeah,
and assuming no black swan events like Coinbase being hacked, then I'm not aware of a scenario other than this, like, you know, medium to long term Bitcoin kind of dies. Well,
while he has the convertible debt.
Yeah. Although, I mean, if there's no debt, and if in 10 years Bitcoin is worth $10,000 or $1,000, it's not paying off either. Yeah. it might not be bankrupt.
Even though he doesn't have to pay the yield on the preferreds, if he doesn't, you know, he's not technically obligated, but if he were to not do
the
it,
market will react. Cause,
yeah,
obviously, it would be a bad problem. But
yeah, and I also see, you know, people I respect saying that, like, people who own Strategy or Stretch are like the XRP army, and like, what is that?
Yeah,
this is so different than XRP and Ripple. It makes me.
You should never confuse Stretch or MicroStrategy's stock
with Bitcoin
as cold self custody Bitcoin. That's not the same thing.
They're two different things.
It's a different type of tool that touches on the market for native Bitcoin, but is not itself. Doesn't have the properties of native Bitcoin.
Yeah, 100%.
It's interesting to people who care about Bitcoin because it's introducing a lot of the rest of the world to this thing that they might otherwise not care about for freedom, censorship, sovereignty, any of those reasons. They might just care about, like, hey, I want yield. And now they're part of the team.
And now they start reading, hey, how is this working? Oh, what is Bitcoin?
Yeah. So it's kind of a massive way to market the ideas that don't require you to be cypherpunk ideals. You can just say, I just like yield. And then you might become curious about Bitcoin. But it's not the same thing. It's a different thing.
And no one, I think, would ever claim it's the same thing. So,
yeah.
All righty.
All right. Good show, guys.
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th. And next time we see, DK, you can give us your updated thoughts on US Men's National Soccer.
Perfect. Will do.
All right.
All right.